the Narragansett sachems, was willing to talk. Peter claimed the tribe possessed a total of 3,000 fighting men, most of them gathered together with their women and children in the depths of a giant swamp to the southwest. As the English had learned in pursuing Philip, under normal conditions, it was almost impossible to fight the Indians in a swamp. But these were not normal conditions. It had been a bitterly cold December, so cold that the wetlands had frozen solid. As a consequence, Winslow could now take his army just about anywhere. The real problem was how to find the Narragansetts. It was true that there were no leaves on the trees, but the swamplands around modern Kingston, Rhode Island, were still so dense with undergrowth that even the most experienced guide would have difficulty navigating them to the Indians' lair. Peter, however, claimed he could find it. For them to move on the Narragansetts, Winslow had to march his army south to Jira Bull's garrison in modern Narragansett, Rhode Island. From there, it should be a 6 to 7 mile march to the swamp. But on December 15th, Winslow received disturbing news. The Indians had attacked the garrison, killing 15 people and burning it to the ground, effectively robbing him of a location from which to launch the attack. Even more troubling was that the Connecticut soldiers under the command of Major Treat had not yet arrived. 2 days later, Winslow learned that Treat and 300 English and 150 friendly Mohegan and Pequot Indians had arrived at the burned-out shell of Bull's garrison. The next day, Winslow's force set out to the south, arriving at the garrison around 5 in the evening. The next day was a Sunday, but Winslow decided he had no choice but to attack. Otherwise, his entire army might freeze and starve to death. The frigid temperatures had frozen in the supply ships that were to provide his soldiers with food. Most of his men had only enough provisions to last them a single day. With the garrison in ruins, his army had no shelter during one of the coldest nights in New England's history. The temperature was not only bitterly cold, it had begun to snow. "That night was very snowy," Captain Oliver wrote. "We lay 1,000 in the open field that long night." By morning, the snow was 2 to 3 feet deep. Even before the men headed out at 5 a.m., the hands of many were so frostbitten that they were unable to work their muskets. For 8 hours, they marched without stop through the drifting snow, with Mosley's company in the lead and with the soldiers from Connecticut taking up the rear. What was to have been just a 7-mile trek proved more than double that as the army was forced to follow a circuitous route along the high ground to the north. Finally, around 1 p.m., they came to the edge of a dense swamp. Indians began to fire from the trees and bushes, and Peter announced that they had arrived at their destination. Winslow appears to have had no particular plan of what to do next. 2 Massachusetts companies, led by Captains Johnson and Davenport, pursued the Indians into the swamp without, Hubbard wrote, staying for word of command, as if everyone were ambitious who should go first. They had not gone far when they were presented with a truly awe-inspiring sight. Ahead of them, looming above the frozen, snow-covered swamp, was a huge wooden fort. No one had ever seen anything quite like it. Set on a 5-acre island and containing approximately 500 wigwams and thousands of Indians, the fort combined elements of native and European design. In addition to a palisade wall of vertically planted tree trunks, the fort was surrounded by a 16-foot-thick hedge of clay and brushwork. At the fort's corners and exposed points were flankers and what the English described as blockhouses, structures made of tree branches from which the Indians could fire at anyone attempting to scale the wall. The fort had a single point of entry, where a massive tree trunk spanned a moat-like sheet of frozen water. Any Englishman who attempted to cross the tree trunk would be picked off by the Indians long before he made it into the fort. If they had any hope of breaching the wall, they must find another way in. Peter, their Indian guide, was not sure whether there was in fact an alternative entrance. Hubbard later insisted that it was God who led the English to the one place where there was a possibility of piercing the Indians' defenses. in a remote corner of the fort, there was a section that appeared to be unfinished. Instead of vertical logs and a thick clay barrier, there was a section of horizontally laid tree trunks that was just 4 feet high and wide enough for several men to scramble into the fort at a time. But what soon became known as the Trees of Death was probably not, as the English assumed, an unfinished portion of the fort. Rather than an Achilles' heel, it may have been an intentional feature designed to direct the English to a single, defensible point. On either side of the gap were flankers, where Indians, equipped with muskets, could rake any soldiers who dared to storm the opening. There was also a blockhouse directly across from the opening to dispose of anyone who managed to enter the fort. If the Narragansett's supplies of gunpowder had held out throughout that long afternoon, the English would have come to realize just how ingenious the design of this fort really was. In the end, the fort provided eloquent proof of who were the true aggressors in this conflict. Instead of joining the Poconocuts and Nipmucks, the Narragansett had spent the fall and winter doing everything in their power to defend themselves against an unprovoked Puritan attack. If ever there was a defensive structure, it was this fort. And now 1,000 English soldiers were about to do their best to annihilate a community of more than 3,000 Indian men, women, and children who asked only to be left alone. As soldiers spread themselves along the perimeter and poured shot at the fort, the companies led by Captains Johnson and Davenport prepared to go in. With the officers leading the way, they charged the 4-foot-high section of the fort. As soon as Johnson reached the logs, he was shot dead. Captain Davenport was wearing a very good buff suit, and it was believed the Indians mistook him for General Winslow himself. He was hit 3 times, and after handing his musket to his lieutenant, died of his wounds. The fire from the flankers and blockhouse was so fierce that those soldiers who were not already dead fell on their faces and waited for reinforcements. It was now time for Captains Mosley and Gardner to give it a try. Mosley later bragged that once inside the fort, he saw the muskets of 50 different Indians all trained on him. Mosley survived the onslaught, but his men were unable to make any significant progress into the fort. Next came Major Appleton and Captain Oliver. Instead of a helter-skelter rush, they organized their men into a storming column. Crying out, "The Indians are running!" Appleton's and Oliver's men were able to push past their comrades from Massachusetts Bay and take the flanker on the left side of the entrance. In addition to reducing the deadliness of the Indians' fire by approximately 1/3, the capture of the flanker provided the soldiers with some much-needed protection. Holding his own Plymouth companies in reserve, Winslow sent in the soldiers from Connecticut. Although one of the flankers had been taken, no one had informed the Connecticut officers of the danger posed by the blockhouse directly opposite the entrance. Major Treat and his men ran headlong into fire so deadly that 4 of 5 Connecticut captains were killed. The soldiers were, in Hubbard's words, enraged rather than discouraged by the loss of their commanders, and pushed on into the fort. As the fighting raged on, Benjamin Church began to regret his decision not to lead a company of his own. Impatient of being out of the heat of the action, he importunately begged leave of the general that he might run down to the assistance of his friends. Winslow reluctantly yielded to his request, provided that Church take some soldiers with him. 30 Plymouth men instantly volunteered, and Church and his makeshift company were on their way into battle. Church had no sooner entered the fort than he saw many men and several valiant captains lie slain. There were also many Indian bodies, with more than 50 corpses piled high in a corner of the fort. To his left, fighting amid the wigwams, was a friend of Church's, Captain Gardner of Salem. Church called out to Gardner, and the two men exchanged glances when the captain suddenly slumped to the ground. Church ran up to him and, seeing blood trickle down Gardner's cheek, lifted up his cap. Gardner looked up at Church, but spoke not a word. A bullet had passed through his skull, and before Church could say anything, Gardner was dead. Studying the wound, Church realized that the bullet had come from the upland side of the swamp, and therefore must have come from an English musket. As soldiers pulled Gardner's body from the fort, Church sent word back to Winslow that English soldiers were being killed by their comrades behind them. Now that the tide had turned in the direction of the English, it was time for General Winslow to apply some method to his army's advance. With between 300 and 400 soldiers inside this extremely confined space, the English posed as much a threat to themselves as did the Narragansetts, who, after several hours of fighting, were beginning to run out of gunpowder. Church could see that many of the warriors had started to abandon the fort, leaving large numbers of native women, children, and elderly trapped in their wigwams. Instead of running away, the warriors had taken up positions amid the bushes and trees of the swamp and were firing on the English soldiers inside the fort. It was clear to Church that the fort had been effectively taken. It was time for him to take care of the Indians in the swamp. Church led his men out of the fort, and they soon found a broad, bloody track where the Indians had dragged away their dead and dying men. They came upon an Indian who, instead of firing on them, pulled his gun across his chest in a sign of peace. Hoping to acquire some useful information, Church ordered his men not to hurt the Indian. But to Church's great grief and disappointment, a soldier coming up from the rear killed the Indian before he had a chance to speak with him. A shout erupted from the swamp, somewhere between them and the fort. It was a group of Narragansetts running from tree to tree as they fired on the English. Now the trick was to attack the Indians without being killed by the soldiers inside the fort. After alerting a sergeant to their presence, Church led his men to a dense clump of bushes just a few yards behind the Indians, who were preparing to fire a coordinated volley at the fort. Church and his men were about to attack them when the sergeant cried out to hold their fire. They were about to kill friend Indians. But as Church soon realized, these were not Mohegans and Pequots, these were Narragansetts. And there was now, in Church's words, a formidable black heap of them preparing to fire on the unwitting sergeant and anyone else unlucky enough to be near him. "Now, brave boys," Church whispered to his men, "if we mind our hits, we may have a brave shot. Let our sign for firing on them be their rising up to fire into the fort." Soon after, the Indians stood up in a group to fire, but not before Church and his men gave them such an unexpected clap on their backs that those who were not dead were soon running in confusion. About a dozen of them even ran back into the fort and took refuge in the blockhouse. Church and his men quickly followed and approached the blockhouse. The structure appeared to be quite rickety. Church described it as a sort of hovel that was built with poles after the manner of a corn crib. And he decided that the best strategy was simply to topple it over with the Indians still inside. They were running toward the blockhouse when Church realized that one of the Narragansetts had pushed his musket through a gap in the poles and that the gun was pointed not just in his direction, but at his groin. The next thing Church knew, he had been hit by three pieces of lead. The first bullet buried itself harmlessly into a pair of mittens rolled up inside his pocket. The second cut through his breeches and drawers, but only nicked him in the side. It was the third bullet that almost killed him, slicing into his thigh before glancing off his hip bone. As Church fell to the ground, he made sure to discharge his gun and wound the Indian who had wounded him. His men rushed to his side and began to carry him out of the fort. But Church insisted that they first complete their mission, especially since the Indians had no charges left in their muskets. But as they prepared for another assault on the blockhouse, the Indians started to shoot at them with arrows, one of which cut into the arm of the soldier whom Church was clutching for support. Without their commander to lead them, the Plymouth soldiers became, in Church's words, discouraged and abandoned their attempt to upset the blockhouse. But by this time, Church's attention was elsewhere. It was approaching 5 in the evening, and with darkness coming on, some of the soldiers had begun to set fire to the wigwams inside the fort. This was a needless, potentially disastrous act. Not only did the wigwams contain hundreds of native women and children, they possessed tons of provisions. In fact, there were so many baskets and tubs of corn and meat lining the interiors of the wigwams that Church claimed they had been rendered musket-proof. A former commissary general, he quickly assessed the situation. The colonial army was on the verge of starvation. It was already close to sundown, and there were at least 16 snow-covered miles between them and the Smith garrison at Wickford. dozens, if not hundreds, of men, himself included, were wounded, and a march of this length in sub-freezing temperatures was tantamount to collective suicide. Instead of burning the Narragansett fort and the valuable food it held, they should take up residence in it for the night. After helping themselves to the Indians' corn and meat, and keeping themselves warm within the snug confines of the wigwams, they could set out the next day for Wickford. Someone must stop these men from torching the fort. The orders to destroy the fort had just come from the general himself. Church pleaded with the soldiers to desist from firing the wigwams until he had a chance to speak with Winslow. With the assistance of at least one of his men, Church hobbled out of the fort to the low hill where the general surveyed the action from the saddle of his horse. Winslow listened to Church's impassioned appeal and, after conferring with some of the officers gathered around him, decided that the proposal had much merit. The army would do as Church had suggested and move into the fort for the night. Winslow had begun to ride toward the fort when Captain Mosley suddenly appeared from the edge of the swamp and asked whither he was going. Winslow replied that he was about to enter the fort. Mosley grabbed the reins of the general's horse and exclaimed, "His life was worth 100 of theirs, and he should not expose himself." Winslow said that Mr. Church had informed him that the fort was taken, and that it was most practicable for him and his army to shelter themselves in the fort. "Church lies," Mosley thundered. The fort was not yet secure. If the general moved another inch, he would shoot his horse out from under him. Had Church not been injured, he might have countered Mosley's insubordination with a threat of his own. But as it was, he was barely conscious from loss of blood. It was then that a doctor in the group joined the fray, insisting that Church's proposal would kill more men than the enemy had killed, for by tomorrow the wounded men will be so stiff that there will be no moving them. Noticing that Church had a serious wound of his own, the doctor threatened to deny him medical attention if the general decided to follow his aide's advice, claiming Church should bleed to death like a dog before they would endeavor to stench his blood. It was almost laughably ironic. Throughout the weeks and months of the first phase of the war, the English had been obsessed with building forts. Now that they had a perfectly serviceable and well-stocked fort at their disposal, all they wanted to do was destroy it. The difference, of course, was that this was a native-built structure. For Indian haters like Mosley, the idea of sleeping in a wigwam and eating the Indians' food was abhorrent. It was far better to consume this wretched fortress in purifying fire than spend a single night living like the heathen enemy. There was also a more justifiable fear of ambush. They had 16 miles to cover before they reached the safety of the Smith garrison in Wickford. An Indian captive claimed that in addition to the Narragansett warriors who had survived the attack, there were another 1,500 waiting just a mile and a half away. If they did not leave immediately, before the Narragansetts had the chance to regroup, their battered and exhausted soldiers would be virtually defenseless against a well-executed native ambush. Best to depart while the enemy was still reeling from the attack. The Plymouth governor might have been named commander of this army, but Massachusetts Bay was apparently in charge. Winslow once again reversed himself, and the fort, along with all its provisions, and perhaps hundreds of native women, children, and elderly, was consigned to the fire. Contemporary accounts of the battle focus on the bravery of the English officers and soldiers, but make little mention of the slaughter that followed the taking of the fort. It must have been a horrendous and terrifying scene, as Narragansett women and children screamed and cried amid the gunshots and the flames. 38 years before, Narragansett warriors had been sickened by the burning of the Pequot Fort at Mystic, Connecticut. On this day, December 19, 1675, Pequot warriors were there to watch the Narragansetts meet a similar fate. The English later claimed that the Pequots and Mohegans had been faithless allies that day, firing their muskets up into the air rather than at the enemy. One can hardly blame them if the claim was true. Sometime after 5 o'clock, the order was given to begin the long march to Wickford. According to one account, the flames rising up from the burning fort lit the army's way for as many as 3 miles through the wilderness. It was the worst night of the soldiers' lives. They had spent the previous night attempting